Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com. This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 2, for July 21st, 2006. Dr. Leonard Guaranty.
Well, today's guest is Dr. Leonard Guaranty, and he's a Novartis professor of biology at MIT's Department of Biology. He's written a great book called Ageless Quest, and it's one scientist's search for genes to prolong youth. And this is was a fun read. I read it last night, and it really inspires one to think about you know, the major Pandora's box. Is it possible to genetically manipulate humans and to extend their lifespan? So, but I don't want to explain this. I'd rather we ask Dr. Leonard Guaranty to go into this, because it's just an amazing field of research right now, and a lot of what we know, if not the most important elements of what we know, is from his work. So, and we're very fortunate to have him here today to discuss it. Welcome.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
How did you choose to study aging?
I thought it was a quite an important problem in biology that remained unsolved.
At the time you began, was there a notion that there might be a genetic component to aging?
Well, there was, because even when we began, which was in 1991, it was known that in roundworms, there was a mutation called AGE1 that Tom Johnson had studied that made the worm live longer. So there was already at least a hint that there was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
I think in Johnson's studies, the extension was about 30-40%, something like
that. Well, that's significant.
Could we translate that into human years? I mean, is there like a dog years for roundworms?
Well, the percentage is a percentage. So for humans, that would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
Is there evidence in human populations from around the world that there's a sort of an inherited element to this as well? We all hear stories about some, very distant country that has people that live on a specific diet and they live much longer and healthier.
Yeah, most of those stories turn out to be apocryphal if you look into them. But I think there is information on humans, I think the most believable of which is based on twin studies, looking at identical twins versus fraternal twins, sort of the standard way of measuring the genetic contribution to any given characteristic. And I think those experiments lead to the view that part of lifespan is, at least, is genetic, but not all of it.
So you chose to, you were already working on yeast, studying gene expression.
That's right.
Why did you pick yeast to study aging? I mean, it seems...
It was a big transition to go to a new problem, aging, to begin with. And to go to a new system, a new organism, would have been, I think, too much. So this at least enabled us to have some continuity in making the transition to aging, and that we could continue working on the same system, just studying a different aspect of it.
Is the theory that there is some sort of biological switch that flips at a certain age that just causes you to start to age, or is it something, a lifelong process?
No. I think that there is out there the view that aging is a program, but I don't believe that. And people who have thought about this for years, evolutionary biologists, have argued that it's not a program. And the argument is that what aging is due to is what happens after natural selection can no longer be effective, and that is in a post-reproductive phase of life. So what they would say is natural selection keeps everything robust until we reproduce, and at that point, we've succeeded genetically, and selection wanes, and so things tail off. And they would say that aging, therefore, has many causes, many genes, and is a more or less intractable quagmire.
But it's not that we wear out. It's that life is done with us.
It's not that we wear out, but it is as though our cells lose function. And when cells lose function, then organs begin to lose function. And then that becomes incompatible with survival. So what I think the big deal, the big breakthrough, I think, in this whole field is the realization that while aging is not a program, it can be regulated under some circumstances. And the primary example of that is calorie restriction or food restriction. And there are many examples now where calorie restriction slows down aging in rodents and in other systems.
And you're talking so, significant calorie restriction, 40%
that's right.
Underneath the,
right.
The normal.
People usually use 30 to 40% restriction. So it's quite severe, but the animals live way longer. So that says that there's some, what we could begin to think about as a program that takes place under that diet that enables the animal to live longer. And one can further think that such a program, if one use the term, has adaptive value, because what in the face of food scarcity, you can sort of slow down and keep young until food reappears. And if there's a boom-bust cycle of food being present and absent, if you can survive the famine and reproduce when food reappears, that's a big advantage. So you can imagine it's adaptive. And if it is adaptive, then it could be controlled by a relatively small number of genes.
So there's an evolutionary strategy, which I guess is required for it to become a genetic effect, right?
That's right. I mean, I think the old view of aging is that there are many causes and many genes that contribute to it. And I agree with that. I think that's basically correct. But the saving grace for us as scientists is that under some circumstances, that is to say, low caloric intake, aging is slowed down by a genetic program.
So this would be something like caloric restriction in response to a famine would allow you to survive longer and then potentially after the famine reproduce. But how is reproduction affected by and how are
in
physiology?
In the laboratory, reproduction is slowed down. So the mice that are calorie restricted in the laboratory don't reproduce.
They live longer and they don't reproduce.
They don't reproduce while they're on the low-calorie diet.
And what you're taking this, though, is not so much a prescription for behavior, but just as an indicator that there is some mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm also taking it as a survival strategy. So let's say we had a strain of mouse that could do this and another strain that couldn't do it. And we took both of them, put them on the low-calorie diet for 2 years, let's say. And then we took them off that diet. Then we give them abundant food. Then if you could, if that mouse could have slowed down aging, then when you give it food again, it can now reproduce. Genes can now live on. But the mouse that couldn't do it has gotten too old to reproduce. So either it's dead already or it's post-reproductive.
So natural selection has produced this kind of
I think
adaptation.
So. Yeah. I think so. And that's why it's ubiquitous in nature. Yeast can do it. Fruit flies can do it. Mammals can do it.
So knowing that, what's your next step then in terms of genetic research?
Well, this isn't how we got into it. See, we came in from the point of view of can we identify genes that can make a yeast mother cell live longer? That's how we get into this. I wasn't thinking about calorie restriction at all. So what we did is we looked for mutant yeast, where we would mutate single genes and look for mutants that live longer. And this took us years to go through this. And what came out of yeast was a single gene called SIR2. And the relationship between the SIR2 gene and aging was that the more SIR2 activity there was in cells, the slower the aging and the longer the lifespan. So SIR2 emerged as an anti-aging gene. And what amazed us was that the same gene then we found did the same thing in roundworms. Having more SIR2 enabled roundworms to live longer. So that's a very conserved mechanism that it spans from yeast to roundworms, and really that says this is universal. We all have SIR2 genes, and they're anti-aging genes in all systems. It's a very profound thing. And I was bewildered by this and wondered why this should be the case. And then we started studying what the SIR2 gene actually does in cells biochemically. and we found it encodes a protein that has a particular activity as an enzyme so that the enzyme can regulate the kinds of genes that are turned on and off in cells. But the important thing about this enzyme is that it required a critical metabolic molecule in cells called NAD. And this was a very unusual combination of a requirement for NAD to then go and turn on and turn off genes. So thinking about that, I thought that, well, that puts SIRT2 kind of at the nexus between metabolism in cells and aging. And that's when I started the hypothesis that maybe this is the gene that is responsible for the effects of calorie restriction on longevity.
Have you been able to see that connection?
I believe we're seeing it. This is still evolving, but I think we have pretty good data in the yeast case that the SIRT2 gene is doing this. It's allowing yeast cells to live longer.
But you can't calorie restrict yeast.
Can.
You can?
Oh. Yes. Yeah. So the calories.
I guess they have to eat something, huh?
They eat something, and they eat glucose, which is a carbohydrate, and you can simply dilute it down, so give them less of it, and they will live longer if you do that. And if you knock out this gene, then they won't live longer on the lower
glucose.
Very
interesting. Wow.
So that's important. And now, more recently, other labs have found the same relationship in fruit flies. So again, that speaks, as I think, to a universal mechanism that will go through this family of genes, SIRT2 and genes that are homologous to SIRT2, that these genes somehow can sense the diet and can respond to the amount of calories in the diet, really the amount of food that we're eating, so that if food is spare, aging can be slowed down. So that's the hypothesis we made 6 years ago when we discovered the enzymatic activity of SIRT2, and I think the hypothesis so far has been vindicated.
The link between metabolism and the gene SIRT2 that you identified, doesn't that suggest that aging is or the extension of life is not it's not a passive event, but it's
yes.
a result of the activation
the
of the genes?
Extension of life by food restriction would be an active event because it would require a regulatory gene. So the old thinking about calorie restriction extending life passively because everything slows down, damage slows down, so of course the animal lives longer. I think we have to revise that and think of it as something rather active that requires a regulator to sense the low calories in the first place and then to create an output that will extend the lifespan. SIRT2 can create that output because what it does in cells is influence the expression of many genes.
So I'm getting a sense that there's almost a chain reaction that's happening here at ultimately activating the SIRT2 gene.
You could call it a chain reaction. I mean, basically, it's simple in that at least the hypothesis is simple. Now, it may turn out that the reality is more complicated, but the hypothesis is just that when you for example, limit calories in the diet, then you can send a signal to SIRT2. And the way you can send that signal is through this small metabolic molecule called NAD. Okay? And the details of that are still being worked out. But what we think happens is NAD interconverts with a related molecule called NADH. And they interconvert depending on the metabolism, the metabolic activity of cells. And it's the ratio of NAD to NADH that sets the activity of SIRT2. So we can imagine a pathway that's not all that complicated that goes from diet to this small molecule, NAD and NADH, immediately to SIRT2 to set the activity of SIRT2. And then there are effects on gene expression, which then predisposes the cells to living longer or shorter.
NAD is also part of the oxidation cycle, yes?
Yes, it's involved in literally hundreds of metabolic reactions involving oxidation and reduction.
Is that a connection to the antioxidants in food and
I don't think
purported
so.
Health? No.
I mean, superficially it is, but I think it's a much stronger connection to metabolism in cells that one necessarily would affect metabolism when diet changes. And that can be sensed by SIRT2 because of a change in these the NAD and NADH molecules.
So is it too soon to start thinking about ways to apply this information?
Oh, I think it's not. And, you know, there are at least two companies now out there that got founded on this premise. One was a company that I was involved in starting some 6-7 years ago called Elixir Pharmaceuticals. And another is a company that one of my former postdocs, David Sinclair, has started more recently called CERT. And both of these companies are really interested in trying to develop strategies to intervene in this process based on what we've learned in the laboratory.
Would they be strategies of calorie restriction, or would they be something closer to the SIRT2 gene?
Well, what you would want is to develop small molecule drugs that could mimic the effects of calorie restriction. That would be the ideal.
Yeah, because so we'd like to keep eating if we can.
Like to keep eating, or at least not starve, because starving is is not fun. And people who do this diet seem to be miserable. It's very, very difficult.
You live longer, but it feels a lot longer.
It feels a lot. Even if you don't live longer, it would seem like you did. And so one wants to think of drugs. But the important thing about these this strategy to consider is it harks back to the rodents again, because not only do they live longer on this low-calorie diet, but if you take rodents that are models for all of the major diseases of aging, those diseases are mitigated by the low-calorie diet, and those include cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative disease. In each case, there are rodent models where they develop these diseases, and in each case, the disease is slowed down or prevented altogether by calorie restriction. So if we had mimetics for calorie restriction based on this research, you could really think about trying these in clinical trials based on disease, and not simply as something that's going to make people live longer.
They'd be healthier.
Forestall diseases.
Interesting.
I have two questions for you. One is SIRT2 is an enzyme, and typically when going after drug discovery, one looks to knock out that enzyme. In fact, if you want to induce the benefits of caloric restriction, you have to activate it. Is that been a problem in the pathway of drug discovery for?
I think you make a very good point. It's much more difficult to conceive of ways to activate an enzyme than to inhibit it. There are many, many drugs on the market now based on inhibiting enzymes, but very few, if any, based on activating enzymes. So the answer to that is we don't know, but there are possible silver linings in that cloud. The first is that there may be natural out there that already exist in nature that activates SIRT2. And this is something that Dr. Sinclair has focused on. So plants make molecules called polyphenols. One of the best known of them is called resveratrol. And these are at least touted as molecules that plants produce that animals eat. And in the animals, these molecules are capable of activating SIRT2. So there would be signals that are out there already that in nature exist to activate sirtuins. Now, if that's true, if that turns out to be true, then that gives us a huge head start on a strategy to develop drugs that do that, because molecules already exist that do it. We can tweak them in the laboratory and so on, but we at least have a platform to begin to think about going after this.
Where is the activity of the enzyme? Is it universally expressed in all cells? Because a drug would have to get targeted to a specific site. Or not.
Yeah, so these, like any drug, it would have to get into cells. And at least this particular compound, resveratrol, and its family are capable of getting into cells. So they would be able to reach the SIRT2 to affect its activity. The other way one can think about being able to activate these enzymes is kind of indirectly. You know, in cells, there's a pathway. I mentioned that they're regulated by the ratio of NAD to NADH, remember. And so if one had a way to tweak that ratio in cells, then one could indirectly affect the activity of sirtuins in an upward direction. So I think that there are possibilities out there. But
how about increased respiration through exercise?
I think that's a good point. So in the yeast case, we post about how calorie restriction works, respiration does go up. You lower the glucose, and that's an integral part of activating SIR2 because that changes it, increases the ratio of NAD to NADH in cells. So I think activity may or may not do it. I think the data is not all in on that, but certainly perturbing pathways inside of cells, for example, pathways that make NAD and NADH, you could think of perturbing those pathways so that you could change that ratio and perhaps indirectly change the activity of SIRT2.
How close are we to actually having a therapy of some kind?
Well, one never knows until one has it. But I would say ballpark 10 years.
So there's nothing that you would recommend at this point?
No, I mean, at this point, at this point, what I would say is all one can do is use common sense. And we know a lot about things that affect human health that don't rely on calorie restriction. So we know what fats are good for us, what fats are bad. I would take that information into account. Stay away from trans fats. Ingest oils that are known to be good, like olive oil. We know smoking's bad, so that's a no-brainer. We know that obesity is bad, so I think it's reasonable that people set a body weight for themselves. That if they're not at that body weight, they get to it, and if they're there, they stick to it, and that would involve both diet and exercise. And I think if you do all that sensibly, that's the best you can do right now.
I don't think you could ignore the novel class of pharmaceutical here, though, that could be potentially, as you said, in 10 years, one where it would be almost mandatory for a population to take, for example, pregnant women take folic acid, and it's highly recommended that all pregnant women take it. If you could delay the onset of diabetes and cancer and protein folding diseases like Parkinson's and how could a government, not look at this data and say, well, it should be part of the, if you want to get health insurance, you better take this drug.
That's how I think about it. I mean, I think it's a little, there are drugs potentially out there now that don't do that, but that one could right away say have broad benefit people should take, for example, aspirin. So when I turned 50, I went on my doctor just recommended just start taking low dose aspirin. Because, there's only upside. For a lot of people, this would fall into the same category. They're very benign drugs in terms of side effects, yet they have significant effects on cholesterol levels and ought to, in the long run, be quite good. And, I think that these drugs would fall into that category potentially in very dramatic fashion.
Well, definitely dramatic.
I'm almost 50 now, so let's say in 10 years this therapy occurs. Is it too late for me?
I don't think so.
So will it reverse aging?
No, I'm not saying that. But what we do know is in the rodents that are put on the calorie restriction diet later in life, like halfway through their life, they still get some benefit from that. So, I think there's reason to believe that even if you went on this rather late in life, you would still derive some benefit.
It's not too late for me.
How about diabetics? Does activating SIR2 modify the sensitivity to glucose by modulating caloric restriction behavior or physiology?
I would say all the data is not in yet, but there were two papers published last year that show that the mammalian SIR2 orthologue, the gene closest to the yeast SIR2 in the human genome called SIRT1, actually regulates insulin production in pancreatic beta cells, the cells that make the insulin hormone. So there's a direct link in mammals between the mammalian SIR2 and glucose homeostasis. So I think clearly there's going to be a application of what we're learning in the field of diabetes and metabolic syndrome.
Fascinating.
Does it activate the consumption of fat from white fat cells as well?
What we know about the mammalian SIRT1 now is that it seems to be a negative regulator of fat. So if you put this protein into pre-adipocytes. It inhibits their differentiation into adipocytes, and it inhibits the accumulation of fat. If you put that raise the level of SIR2 in cells that are already adipocytes and contain fat, it will drive out some of the fat, so they'll have less fat. So there's certainly an anti-fat activity that SIR1 has, and so it's one can think of it as regulating lipids, and it's also regulating glucose homeostasis, which are really two critical axes that are affected by diet, and they're affected both by calorie restriction, which improves the profile for both glucose homeostasis and lipids. And they're affected by this metabolic syndrome that seems to be overtaking the country now, which is a pre-diabetic state in which lipids and glucose are affected unfavorably.
And you could live 30% longer. I think this is absolutely remarkable.
Let me ask, though.
I have to honestly say my feeling is that there's tremendous focus on the longevity aspect of this. But I think that the big potential for people is the disease aspect.
Yeah. Yeah, quality of life as opposed to length of life.
Is there a lot of things that could prevent you from living longer?
Right.
That's a big promise to make, yeah, that people are going to live 30 years longer.
Do you ever think about, I mean, this is outside the realm of science, but do you ever think about the ethical issues involved in prolonging life 30%? I mean, there's a reason why nature does wind things up after we reproduce.
Well, but the way I think of it is that ethically it's something that you have to do. Because we live very significantly longer than we lived 100 years ago, okay, more than 30%.
But our diet is higher. We have an increased diet.
But to get back to the ethical question, is that back that we live longer now than we lived 100 years ago? I think most people would say that shows that the success of medicine and health, et cetera.
But it's also added to population pressure and so forth.
Not so much, because the regions of the world that really are adding to the population pressure consist mostly of young people. I mean, they have very young average age. So I think that the effect on world population of making people who are at a later stage of life healthier and maybe live a little longer are small at best.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly one of those questions that, as an individual, you might say, well, I'd like to live as long as possible. But as a society...
As a society, people could be productive longer.
Right.
A higher fraction of their life. And not be a drain on the healthcare system for as long a period. Then, to me, again, that's societally a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have large pharmas started to look into this? You are the Novartis professor of biology. Has Novartis looked into Elixir? And
I must say the large pharmas have been very, very sluggish on this. And part of the reason is they're very conservative. Part of the reason, I think they just don't get it. I think they don't get it. They don't understand the intimacy of the link between aging and diseases. And it's like turning around a huge ocean liner. It's a slow process.
Do you imagine a therapy that would begin in the womb and continue throughout your life? How do you imagine this being used?
I imagine it being used later in life, like after you have your kids.
Because that's when it becomes an issue.
That's when it becomes an issue, and we won't know until we have the drugs, but there may be an effect on fertility.
Right, right. Because, of course, there is from calorie restriction.
Yeah, and that's what makes sense in terms of the biology. But we have to see. But I certainly wouldn't imagine using it at an early stage of life. There would be no point.
The only reason I thought of it is when you talked about the connection between that and fat cells. I thought perhaps that might be something that people would use as a therapy.
It's true. I mean, metabolic syndrome, really, it keeps hitting people at a younger and younger age, including young people. So, again, that's where the disease angle comes in. Maybe you would use it in younger people to treat obesity and metabolic syndrome.
Right.
But if a woman were to take the drug at an early age because she's pursuing a career and she needs to delay or allow her to be able
to
reproduce
a birth
later.
Pill, Mike.
No, not a birth control. But what I'm saying here is people want to have kids later in life often. And he was saying that Dr. Grant, he was saying that when mice were put on it, they would live for 2 years. And then after, only they were able, young enough to reproduce. I mean, there's so. This is one of the. This is a huge Pandora's box of fantastic biology here.
That's a really interesting idea. I don't know if people would do that or not. Of course, it's already happening that women are having children much later than a generation or two generations ago.
It'd be healthier, less risky for them to take the drug if they are entering a PhD program or an MD program at 28 and want to have kids at 40. If people are already taking this in animal data, I mean, animal data is pretty powerful. If you're going from yeast, worms, flies to mice and primates and dogs, you know, through the standards of today's biotechnology, it would beg the question, why wouldn't someone do this?
Yeah, no, you make a really interesting observation.
Let me ask you, Dr. Guarente, what's next for you? Where do you want your research to take you next?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm a molecular biologist, and we're really focused on mice now and mammals. So we've moved from yeast to worms to mammals, and you know, there are seven genes in mammals that have sequence homology to SIRT2. We talked about SIRT1, which is the closest in sequence and is the orthologue, but there are six others, and I think one needs to understand all seven. So that's where we are. We're trying to figure out what all seven of these do, mice. And once we learn that, I think we'll have a better idea of what pathways we want to target in terms of drug development. But it's a big project. Seven genes is a lot. They don't all do the same thing. They don't, you know, they're not simply redundant. They're expressed in different tissue types. They have different enzymatic activities. They don't all have the same enzymatic activity as SIRT1. And we're trying to figure that all out now.
Do all seven affect lifespan?
Don't know that yet. We don't know that yet. We know that T1 has been knocked out, and it very severely decreases the quality of life for a mouse.
It's just fascinating research. I mean, not only is it the search for the fountain of youth, but it sounds like it's also a search into a very fundamental mechanism in human biology.
I think that this is the big, I mean, I don't know. We get into aging. I didn't know what I was getting into. I thought that maybe we would find that, you know, everybody ages for the same. There's one cause of aging, like telomere shortening or oxidative damage, and that would be universal. And I've come to feel now that was naive, and it's the wrong question even, what causes aging. There are a lot of causes, a lot of things going wrong. And the real value in the whole field is the fact that this thing called calorie restriction has been selected for as adaptive, and so that there really is a program there to tease out and study.
Yeah, I don't see the term aging for me. It refers to more of a passive event. I think the way I would view this is more of as a survival strategy that may be activated and
That's right.
With the benefit of youthfulness. So
That's right.
I think this is this study of youthfulness rather than the study of aging. But I don't want to redefine your field, but it's the benefits to everybody who would consider a therapeutic approach of this is really youthfulness and not aging. And
well,
I think aging,
at a philosophical level. On a practical level, somebody who's already 60 or 70 years old and developing diabetes who takes a drug, I mean, for them, it's a disease therapy.
Well, as Al Gore would say, 58 is the new 57. So, I would like to mention the book again, Ageless Quest, because it was a really great read. Did you... how long did it take you to write this? About a year, did it distract from your research?
Yeah. I just set the time aside. And actually, I started writing it when my son went off to college. So there was kind of empty nest syndrome and free time. And writing the book, I think, helped me fill the time and keep busy.
Are you planning another one, follow-up?
I think so, but I want to wait a little bit longer until we really fully understand what's happening in mammals. And at that point, I think I would like to do a follow-up. I think it's got to be a few more years.
I think that it'd be... somebody's going to, and I know, I think you'd be probably the best person to do it, somebody to, you know, rationalize this or sort of explain it to the masses, because if there's a new class of drugs out there that can give you, you know, an extra 30 years to your life. There's going to be a lot of people wanting to understand that better. And there's so much confusion. If you think about just the Atkins diet, for example, you know, it's physiologists accept many of the dogma or the physiology of going on an Atkins diet, but this regulation of caloric restriction is going to require a really good explanation for, and one that people can understand. So I suppose you're preparing yourself in a couple of years. But
well, the problem is if you really it's difficult to write a book where you actually explain the science in a way that does justice to the science and reaches a broad audience. It's a challenge.
I must admit, we face this challenge every time in a podcast. Yeah, everything gets translated. You know, every time I say a sentence, I sort of think twice about how to translate
it. Well, I do think we found, Professor Quaranty, that the people like you who are in the midst of this research also seem to be very good, probably because of experience at explaining it.
I think it's important for any scientist to be able to explain what they. And if you can't do that in this scientific era, I think you don't survive.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to get money, which means you have to write grants that are clear, easy to read, and understandable.
Yeah, it's been actually really gratifying. When we first started the podcast, I was a little concerned that it might get very abstruse. And what I found is that at least the best people in the field seem very good at explaining themselves.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll provide links. Yeah, provide links to the book in the show notes so that if people want to follow up on it, they can.
I appreciate that.
I didn't realize you mentioned
the book.
Oh, and, yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Dr. Quaranty, thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's very exciting research, and I look forward to what the next 10 years brings.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Quaranty.
Take care. Fascinating fellow, Dr. Leonard Quaranty. Again, we'll put the link in the show notes to the book, which is called what, Mark?
Ageless Quest, One Scientist's Search for the Genes That Prolong Youth by Leonard Quaranty.
Fascinating.
We'll put the links in for sure. This is unbelievable stuff. I mean, on our show with Dr. Lindquist, we were talking about sort of the elements that regulate evolution. Here, we're talking about the genetics of prolonging youth.
But what I come away with in both conversations is that in many senses, we are unlocking mysteries that go very deep to how the human biology works, how all animal biology works. And it's just amazing.
This is what I do with the podcast. So in the blog, futuresinbiotech.blogspot.com, I put in a comment. So you imagine back in 1940, in the late 40s, early 50s, James Watson, right? He had cardboard cutouts and he was first trying to figure out how the pieces of DNA fit together to form a double helix. And he actually, you know, when they figured it out, Watson and Francis Crick, for one day before they submitted the paper to the journal Nature, they understood the human condition and human existence better than anybody ever had since the starting of humanity, right? So they're literally at the frontier. So if we can, you know, find great people like Dr. Quaranty and Dr. Lindquist and Dr. Vidal that are at this frontier, we can maybe give our listeners a hint to that kind of understanding of the human existence. You know, maybe this is heavily philosophical and a lot of people are going to be
no, it's a brave new
comments,
world.
But
no, it's a brave new world we live in, and it's a fascinating thing. We will actually, you mentioned Mark Vidal, we will be talking to Mark Vidal next time on the podcast. In fact, it's such an extensive subject, his cancer research, that we're going to do two parts with Dr. Mark Vidal. So that's something to look forward to. Coming up soon. You have some thank yous you'd like to do?
Yeah. I'd like to thank Olga Vieira, who assisted us in setting up Skype for Dr. Quaranty at MIT. I'd like to thank Harry Gill and Mark Parker for reviewing the show notes. These show notes, they are fairly simple to write, but it takes three PhDs to make sure that there's no typos.
And by the way, a typo that was in there, I propagated myself for a long time, and I apologize, and I got rid of a gene folding and then return to protein folding, or was it vice versa? I can never remember.
It was probably my fault because I wrote it very. I was very excited when I wrote it.
I copied and pasted whatever you had, and then it propagated for a lot longer than your error did, unfortunately.
Yeah, so I'd like to thank Will Hall, too.
Yeah,
Will
this
Hall.
Is great. New music that we're using for the open and close from willhallmusic.com, and we thank him for it. Is he a friend of yours, or just volunteered this?
No, he sent you the email first. He was a fan of the show, and he wrote something just for the show. But I hope to meet him sometime, because he's written some great music. And a lot of those songs that he's put on his webpage would just fit so well with Biotech.
They do.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. He's a percussionist, so a lot of tribal stuff, too. I have a disclaimer as well. I think it's really good to cover our bases with a disclaimer. So the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. And I think that does it.
And we thank you for joining us. If you enjoy this podcast and all the other podcasts on the twit.tv network, remember that your donations are what make it possible. They pay for the equipment, the bandwidth, and keep us in bread and cookies. If you would like to donate, go to twit.tv, TWIT.TV, and click the donation button. I've eliminated the one-year recurring donation. I think that confused a lot of people. They subscribed a year ago and all of a sudden got a bill this year from PayPal. So there's really only two ways to contribute. One is with any amount that's a one-time only donation. And if you'd like to make that $20 a year donation that way, that's fine. There is a recurring donation, which we like. It helps us. We've kept the amount very low. It's just $2 a month. But by using the recurring donation, you help, because we then know we have a steady stream of income. And since our bills come in a steady stream, it's nice to have the steady income as well. Thank you.
It gives
for your
you
support.
Access. Yeah, definitely gives us access.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so we really do appreciate it. It's also paid for the site redesign, and we're working very hard on that too. In fact, I've got to get back to work. So, Mark Pelletier, I know you have some slides to look at. I've got a website to do. We'll see you next time on Futures in Biotech.
Thanks, Leo.